This sort of omnibus format of having a feature length and almost beyond feature length film comprised of shorter films, that kind of omnibus format is much more common in European cinema than in American, where you either have a director giving you several short films or several directors each contributing a half-hour segment. You can think of a lot of precedent in Italian and French film in particular for that. In American film, there are some examples of it, but very few. And there, I think we typically like to have a clearly defined protagonist who will go through whatever they go through for 90 minutes to 2 hours and to stay with that. So this is like more of a short story kind of format.
Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about A Quiet Place, Day One, and Kinds of Kindness, starting with A Quiet Place. I think everybody already knows about the first two movies where it starts after the aliens have landed and they know something about them, that they're aware of sound. You can't make any sort of sound or they'll find you, and that they can't swim. So it's kind of obvious that they were going to make this movie, right, Mike? Because, you know, what happened on day one when the people didn't know anything? The stakes are just so much higher because they're learning as terrible things are happening. In terms of, you know, the studio is always having sequelitis, I thought this one made sense.
Yeah, it's a great way for us to start, I think, because most people will have seen the first film in 2018 or its sequel in 21. And at that point, you can't help wondering, you know, who are these critters? Where are they from? What's going on here? And so it's kind of terrifying. And to the credit of the series, we never do really learn much at all, frankly, about what they are and where they're from. And I think we're probably better off because explanations can be kind of hokey, right? It's like, oh, come on. You're better off just having that menace from outer space. But the crucial things, as you've pointed out, is that they're blind, but they have tremendous powers of hearing, and they're also afraid of water. And I don't know if they like chocolate or not, but, you know, we sort of have like a short list of the do's and don'ts here. And because the menace hit so fast and unexpected in the first film, you're absolutely right, I think, that a prequel is warranted here. As in, well, gee, when did this start? And of course, where is it going to start? Well, you know, New York City, you know, why not? If you're going to have Godzilla-type murder and mayhem, why not New York City? In terms of the viewing experience, I was so appreciative that we had a quiet audience as I watched it, because it would have been absolutely devastating if people talked during the film. I would want the monsters to swoop down and get them. Like, how dare you talk during the movie? We're going to get you. So actually, it really is, the audience is wrapped. And I would say there are two things working in favor of the prequel. The central performance by Lupita Nyong'o is really strong, really anchors the film. And secondly, the film is anchored by the filmmaking itself. It's a well-crafted film, so it really holds the interest that way. Now, having given it a lot of praise that way, I've got to tell you, there were several things about this film that had me rolling my eyes. I did it quietly. Nothing was going to spook down. I was very quiet, but my eyes were rolling. Without spoiling the plot too much, let me, you know, there's not that much plot, but without spoiling what little there is, the things that had me rolling my eyes were threefold. So my two eyes were rolling for these reasons. The first is that she plays a character who is a terminal cancer patient. Indeed, she's living in a hospice. As it starts, they go into Manhattan to see a puppet show of all things. and then all heck breaks loose at that point. What I found almost medically, if not impossible, at least implausible, is she's really somebody who's close to death from the way it's described early in the film. And yet she becomes a relatively conventional action hero as the film. And I thought, my gosh, if I'm ever terminally ill that way in hospice care, I want to sort of be in her shoes that way, that I can run through the streets and I can do this and that and all kinds of heroic actions. Now, emotionally, I'm totally with her. I mean, it really wins you over to just be with her there. But you got to say, like, from a medical standpoint or just a logical standpoint, I think, oh, come on now. What is it now? I know sometimes people in duress have like tremendous powers suddenly, but this is sort of like borderline implausible. So that was nagging at me throughout the film. And then, of course, she's accompanied by a cat. And I won't say anything against cats. It's quite adorable as cats go. But just as she has these powers that keep her going, and she doesn't have any supernatural power. She's very much a human being, but whatever keeps her motivated and going and moving. And we're told throughout the film that she's like low on meds and she's got to get some pills and this and that, but somehow she keeps going, right? So, okay. Likewise, her cat, I'll put it safely and politely and say the cat seems to have more than nine lives. This cat always bounces back and always shows up at just the right moment. Okay, those are conventions of plotting, if you will. And on a sentimental level, and it does work, that she's so heroic and determined and she's got the cat with her. But anyway, that was the one thing that had my eyes rolling. The second thing that had my eyes rolling is this. When she's in Manhattan and basically on her own or almost on her own for much of it, She's decided she needs to reach her favorite pizza joint. Now, it's explained in the storyline in terms of her growing up and her family and, that kind of heartfelt attachment. But quite a few blocks between where she is and where the pizza joint was uptown, she's going to go there. She's got to go there. In effect, sort of like for the last meal, if you will. And what had me smiling was, first of all, that, okay, I understand the sentiment there, but that she'd venture all these dozens of blocks to reach a pizza joint, which might or might not be open under these conditions. But then I was having a kind of sardonic response. Well, New Yorkers have very strong opinions about where the best pizza is in the city, and she knows where the best pizza is, and she's going to get that last slice, if you will. And the movie has a little bit of a, to the extent there's humor in it, it does have a kind of smile on that very point. That was the second thing to have me, though, sort of rolling my eyes. Like, I think I'd stay put and like very quiet, and I wouldn't venture out into the streets too much. But no, I got to get pizza. So the third thing that had me rolling my eyes was that this is a city that's totally being devastated by these creatures. And we do get a good look at them, actually, more so than sometimes in the first two films. And they really are scary. And so the city has been devastated. Buildings are leveled, cars are smashed. You do see people being snatched off the street. Now, this is a curious thing in the film. These monsters are determined to kill humanity. So if you make the slightest noise, it's going to swoop down and get you. And a lot of people are like swept up, and it's really frightening to watch it. I don't think the creatures eat people. I don't see any evidence really that this is their diet. They just seem to enjoy killing for the sake of killing and clearing the ground, if you will. But what's really, I think, like borderline implausible and beyond borderline is the fact that for all the devastation of buildings and cars and people being swept up and so on, you don't see any dead bodies on the street, either that they have been killed by the monsters or crushed in a building that's collapsed. This is where the movie follows conventional Hollywood formula in that you don't want to get your audience too worked up, too disturbed, that people actually die in something like this. So it stays at the level of game playing, you trying to outwit the monster, and you don't have to step over dead bodies on your way as you do it. And on the one hand, I understand that in terms of entertainment value. On the other hand, there are places where, like, this is like one of the most densely populated cities in the world. And yet, for all the devastation, I don't see any dead people. So that's like really, really weird watching it. And think, if you actually think about that as you watch it, there are scenes where she'll walk block after block and you see all that mayhem around you and you see people running in the street, but you don't see anyone who's actually been killed by a monster or crushed by a brick or something. So you just have to like make allowances this way. So my eye rolling ends at this point, and I turn it back to you.
Mike, you have made some great points. New York City, of course, it has to be New York City because it opens with a factoid that New York City has 90 decibels of noise, which is the same as a continuous scream. So, I mean, obviously, the noisiest places on Earth would attract the big monsters first, as opposed to someone having a quiet, sleepy life out in a Kansas prairie somewhere. I agree with you. The side quest was absolutely ridiculous to go get the pizza. Unbelievable given the circumstances. That kind of broke the mood for me because that it just seems silly. Also, it wasn't bad enough that she was dying of cancer. She also has her foot crushed by a car. And so then she has to limp along as well. But I am going to completely disagree with you about the cat. I absolutely loved the cat. I actually looked it up. It's two cats, which I think is interesting because the cat had a very distinctive coloring and a really expressive face. And I'm just surprised they were able to find two cats that could both act in the same
Well, you know
manner.
what? That's actually, I understand why you were surprised, but it's actually not surprising in the sense that when movies have animals that are used extensively, as this cat is, they oftentimes will have a double cast, if you will. Sometimes they'll get sibling dogs or cats, or at least close enough, because, and also this is sometimes done with like babies. Think about human babies, right? How often, because how often will the baby follow a command? How often will the baby smile when you want it to smile? You better have another baby nearby. And also in terms of like labor laws and this and that, how many hours can you require the baby to work per day? I mean, these things are all regulated, right? So human babies oftentimes will be doubled that or tripled that way. And actually animal cast members, again, it's quite common, but I agree with you that as you're watching the film, you would never suspect that's the case. And again, I agree with you completely on a sentimental note that the cat's adorable and it helps with her in terms of bonding because she has enough reason to feel bitter, not just the pain of her cancer and the conditions she's living in, but just that, until she hooks up with a friendly stranger, and we can talk about that, she's pretty much on her own at this point. And thank goodness she has that a cat for company. So it's at the level of, heartfelt sentiment there, and I share it. And also the fact that, rather than just talking to yourself, you can talk to your cat, right? That makes a difference in movies. You don't seem totally crazy if you're talking to something else. It's not crazy to talk to a cat. It is crazy to talk to yourself. So that gives us a little bit of dialogue or monologue, at least that way. But where I still tend to disagree is in the sense, just as she has these powers to keep her going through the street for that pizza, that cat really is almost uncanny in the sense that, like, sometimes they're separated for reasons that have to do with the monsters, but somehow the cat, I know cats can find us under all sorts of circumstances, but that cat always pops up at just the right moment. That's what I'm getting at. That suddenly you think, oh, that cat is lost for sure, crushed. Oh no, look who's at the end of the alley. Nope, that cat's still there. So that's life number 8 or 9, I guess, and it goes from there. So that's actually where it was part of my eye rolling. It's just the way it's handled is definitely a plot device. But honestly, I agree with you. When that cat's on screen, sure, it's adorable. I want it to survive. I want it to attack the monsters, actually. I want it to fight back.
Well, here's something interesting, though. Lupita Nyong'o was afraid of cats, so she had to get therapy so she could work up to first, being in the room with a cat and then touching a cat until she could finally pet a cat. And then, because it's written into the script that way, and she wanted the role bad enough that she dealt with that phobia. So
Well,
that's a lot of work to go through just to play one role.
Marie, we all have our phobias, but what a weird one that is, like to be afraid of cats but not afraid of these monsters, right? So I
Well,
can't figure
cats are
that one out.
real. Cats are real. Now, she is amazing in this, like you said. I mean, she has such an expressive face. And that's what's interesting about this movie is finding ways to communicate messages without words. And she does so much with her facial expressions. Just absolutely astonishing. I thought her acting in this was really, really top-notch. Now, you mentioned the secondary character, the friendly stranger. I thought that seemed a little bit strange to me too, because he latches onto her and she keeps trying to shake him, and he's such a nice guy. She finally helps him. I thought it was a good character. I understand why it was supposed to make her seem, helpful and have her not only have the cat to talk to, but what did you think he brought to the storyline?
Joseph Quinn plays that character, Eric, who's a Brit. They're strangers to each other in various ways. On the obvious level, they just don't know each other, complete strangers. But also, she's American, he's British. There are things that would separate them, if you will. And yet, ultimately, I was starting to roll my eyes on that one, and then I stopped. Do you stop at half mast or what? I don't know. I wasn't rolling the eyes, and I'll tell you why. Because I started thinking about those circumstances. You're in extremis, and the best thing about her actually is that expressive face. I actually wonder what it would be like if we didn't have that encounter, and the two of them hooking up, if we didn't even have the cat. I know you'll disagree on that because you like the cat, but if it was just her, because her face tells the story, you could almost have as a near silent film. Now, I think an avant-garde filmmaker would have done that, to do it actually without, beyond the opening scenes where she's with other people before the crisis and the monsters arrive, but you could do it as an almost silent picture, and that would be fascinating. And there are stretches of it that are almost silent, and her face carries the action there. So anyway, even though when he first popped up, it just struck me as a red flag, plot contrivance, this and that. And then as it went along, I was really struck by not just the awkwardness of it, and I mean that in a complimentary way, but by the fact that if you were living under these conditions and you're on your own and you hooked up with a complete stranger, what would you do? Would you suddenly take to each other, or would you repel each other? And there are early scenes where he's eager to latch on. He's so desperate. He's just so frantic. She's much cooler by way of temperament, and she's not looking for a companion, if you will. He is. And I actually was moved by that after a while, that even when she tries to shake him, he keeps popping. He's almost like that cat. He keeps popping up. But then what I really found quite moving was that she eventually does not only allow him near, but she realizes this is good for her too, and that she'll really do a lot to try to help him. And I thought that gave the film some, when I call it much needed substance, by that I just mean simply fleshing out or filling out their characters, a bit more character psychology that way, and just the interaction of two complete strangers who've now got a united purpose, that it's their peril that brings them together like that. And that really helped hold my interest in the second half of the picture, because otherwise it might just have been like a race. By race, I mean, you're going down the street and the monsters are nearby, and it would just be that sort of primal situation. And at feature length, not that it would wear thin necessarily, but it'd be more of the same. You look around the corner, are the monsters nearby? Can you walk another block? Can you smell the pizza yet? You're getting closer. Yeah, that might carry it, but having him there gives it a little more human complexity, because otherwise, once the film's underway, she has almost no meaningful connection to other human beings. I mean, people run down the street and the monster swoops them up and so on, but it's not like she sits and has a quiet conversation in a corner. So I think it's really important for the film that it gets amplified that way. And then I'm not totally convinced, I'm not going to spoil what happens with the two of them heading off together. For me, there was a bit of contrivance there that didn't quite wash. I wasn't quite convinced by it. And yet, again, emotionally, I was with it. So that's where I think sometimes intellectually I'm rolling my eyes or drawing back, but emotionally, the film's got me hooked. So I went with it that way.
Well, I hope that the Academy Awards considers adding another category for best animal performance. Mostly it's all about the cat. I think though, now that we've seen this one, we've seen the two films they made first. What do you think, Mike? Can there be a fourth one where the humans take the world back?
As you know, I'm not a big advocate for sequels, prequels, remakes, reboots, et cetera. I thought this prequel was warranted. I think you could justify doing a further one, if only because she's such a strong character. And yet, what would you do at, again, what I call the medical level? And I know I'm sounding like somebody totally lacking humor and empathy and so on. But the fact that, if she's so close to death, what would you do in the next one? Is she suddenly in remission? What happens? Well, no, I mean, I'm like, I'm making fun, and maybe I shouldn't, but you just sort of wonder at the level of plausibility. Like, if she was in hospice, does she go back to hospice or what? Does she open her own pizza joint? I don't know. I mean, whatever you decide to do in the next one. So I'm not encouraging another one, but with the way this one, again, without spoiling how it ends, with the way it goes in the home stretch, one could envision, and I'm sure the filmmakers do as well, doing another prequel. But then that sort of begs the question, at what point do you take the prequel up to what would have been what I'm calling present day action for the first film? There are some possibilities there, actually, where you could sort of meld whatever happens in the prequels up to what we know from the first film. I guess you could do that. Film producers are shameless in that respect. So if they're listening to us on this program, they're now heading off to their computers and
Right,
they're
we thought of
working.
it first.
Well, and these films have done well commercially and critically, right? So sometimes you get a prequel or sequel where you feel like, well, who wants this? Who asked for it? This is one, though, where people have been hooked by it. I mean, the audience I saw it with was really rapt. Not raptors, but they were rapt. They were really watching it attentively. And people who like this film and this series at this point, I think, would want to see another one. And I would want to see it, if only for her performance, sure.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to Kinds of Kindness. And I'm just going to say up front, like I did not like this movie. I am not a fan. I like this director. I've liked his other stuff, but this was a big miss for me.
Well, I've got to say, you and I've talked about Yorgos Lanthimos before, and the thing with Lanthimos is he has a cult following, and I'm not part of it. I'm impressed by his imagination, his visual cleverness, and so on. My feeling is oftentimes he does movies that are strange for the sake of being strange. Now, with a film like Poor Things, I like that better than some of his other films because there you have a Frankenstein type story. Thematically, you've got material to work with. You've got some really strong acting and so on. But the other films, to mention some of them quickly, The Favourite, Dogtooth, The Killing of Sacred Deer, The Lobster. Sometimes I just thought they were like extravagantly surreal for the sake of that. So when you get a surreal creature on screen, yeah, it's going to rivet your attention. And some of it is just so inexplicable. Yes, it's going to hold your attention. But, at feature length, for me, it seems. When I use the word precious, I don't mean as in sweet and nice, but just as in self-absorbed, full of his own cleverness and so on. And that bothered me a bit throughout the career, and including in this film. So one thing about Kinds of Kindness that has me sharing your negative response is this. I head into it already not being favorably disposed to the director, push come to shove. And then realizing this film has a running time of 164 minutes, and that's a lot of unkindness in a movie with kindness in the title. And the reason that it runs so long on a pragmatic level is this film actually consists of three shorter films cobbled together, and they share the same cast. So it is interesting to see how the same actors are deployed film by film. That always held my interest. How is he or how is she going to pop up in the next one? Also, thematically, there are some connections between otherwise disparate stories. Namely, I think all the films, all three of them, involve power plays as humans, compete with each other and see who's dominant and so on. So that thematically was a bit of a thread or a bit of a through line, but it really is relentless and really is a slog as you watch it. The other thing that kept me somewhat interested is it started me thinking about the fact that this sort of omnibus format of having a feature length and beyond feature length film comprised of shorter films, that kind of omnibus format is much more common in European cinema than in American, where you either have a director giving you several short films or several directors each contributing a half hour segment. You can think of a lot of precedent in Italian and French film in particular for that. In American film, there are some examples of it, but very few. And there, I think we typically like to have a clearly defined protagonist who will go through whatever they go through for 90 minutes to 2 hours and to stay with that. So this is like more of a short story kind of format. So the individual stories actually, have some interesting plot points, but overall, I just thought this is a film that really is so relentless and so sadistic at times that I just felt like my faith in humanity was being drained minute by minute. So let me turn it back over to you though, because I know you had negative feelings about the film and I'd love to hear them.
Well, first of all, yes, the runtime is far too long for what they're asking you to watch. And sadistic's a great word. And I like the surreal and I like the outright weird. But this went off the deep end. And of the three stories, I thought the first one was actually pretty good. And then the second one got really weird. And then it found another level of weird. The first story is about a man who is enthralled to his employer, who manages his every movement. I don't want to give away the story too much. Each of them have something to do with maintaining a relationship or the status quo. The second one is about a woman who is supposedly drowned, who returns. And it's kind of the return of Martin Guerre kind of a situation. Is it really them? Well, it kind of seems like them, but in certain ways it can't possibly be them kind of thing. And then the third one is about people in a cult. The interesting thing about that one was that at the end, you get more information about the backstory than you start off with, and it kind of skews the way you've been watching the show. But the things I really, really disliked were there's two scenes of animal cruelty. And I know it's an actor, we just talked about the cat. I know nobody actually hurt a dog. I just don't find that at all entertaining. And then there were just some gross out scenes. Now, I dragged my sister to this movie. I said, "You want to see this?" She said, "I love Emma Stone." I said, "Well, going in." I said, "Well, I got to warn you, this director is kind of weird." And I mean, she looked at me a couple of times during some of the scenes, like, "What is this?" And she did not make it through the third installment. She said, "I'll see you in the lobby."
Well, what you should have said is, this movie has Emma Stone, and she's very good doing what she does, but what she does may gross you out. But, she's very good in the film. But you probably should have said it's a Willem Dafoe movie. And that would have let your sister know, this is going to be kind of weird and edgy and so on. And actually, these actors, have worked very well with this director. And in all three stories, actually, the acting is fine. We're objecting more to characters and plot and everything else. The actors are fine. And the actor who deserves credit really more than any other is Jesse Plemons because he features prominently in all three and he's very good actually in each of the roles. So one thing that kept me watching was, again, as I said earlier, to see how they pop up in each story, the actors playing different characters. But then it's really just at the level of actorly craftsmanship, just how convincing they are, how good they are. But while being, as you say, Marie, like really repulsive, you don't want them to succeed. You don't like them. You don't this and that. But credit where credit's due, right? The acting is really quite strong here. I just think this director's hung up on himself. I just think he's totally off the deep end that way. And there is a, speaking of cult, as you mentioned in the third one, I think he does have a cult following. He does have an adamant, if relatively small audience. And Poor Things seemed like it was going to open it up, particularly with Emma Stone winning the Oscar and so on, open up. But I don't see how like a mass audience would exactly turn out in great numbers to watch the kinds of kindness. I think it'd have the reaction of your sister. They'd watch maybe the first story or the second one and then sit out in the lobby. The lobby was a safer place.
I think we said about Poor Things that it's a movie that's not for everybody. To me, this is a movie that's not for anybody. Also, here's something that when you said precious earlier, and I know it's meant to be unusual, but the three chapters are named Death of RMF. RMF is Flying is the second one. And the third one is RMF Eats a Sandwich. And none of those things happen. And also, like, where's the kindness?
Well, that's like a heavy-handed, ironic, reference there, that it's anything but kindness. But in terms of the RMF, we're meant to wonder about it, as you and I are wondering about it. And frankly, it doesn't add up to anything. That's another irritant in the film. It's like yanking the chain. Like, there are going to be these RMF references in each of the films, but there's no real meaning that I could, I refuse to watch it again to try to figure it out. But having watched it once, I just don't see what that's all about. But in terms of things that are precious, I'll add one to our list, because the RMF qualifies as precious in a pejorative sense, right? Self-regarding that way, self-cleverness. The very opening of the film has got a song. It's the Eurythmics, "Sweet Dreams Are Made of This," and I love the song. And I can see how it would be applied to this movie. But again, there's a kind of flippancy. There's a kind of sadistic glibness to something like that, and it extends to not just the song, but the film title itself, "Kinds of Kindness." Well, kindness is the one thing you won't find anywhere in the film, actually. So again, it's a director sort of, sneering at us that way. And if that's your view of humanity, then this is your cup of tea.
I hope it's not most people's idea of humanity because it is dark. And I knew it would be dark going in. I just didn't expect it to be that dark. Now, I did think that at times it had sort of a David Lynch feel, which I did like, and a little bit of Twilight Zone, which I did like. But overall, I was just disgusted with this movie.
When you mention references like that, I've often thought about David Lynch as I've watched his other films, but that's the problem that crops up here. Those are really original talents in the sense that you get a younger, more recent filmmaker like Yorgos Lanthimos, and in his films, I feel like he's citing references in a case like that. And I don't know if he's consciously doing it, but it's like a checklist, right? Oh, that's David Lynch. Oh, that's something. And I don't see enough of an original. I don't want to overstate and say there's no original intelligence here, but it seems like he's often borrowing that way, like from a surrealist lexicon. And he does come up with images that are, you could say, distinctively his, but I don't know what's motivating them beyond wanting to be strange and wanting to be sadistic and different there. The other filmmakers, I'm reluctant to say David Lynch has a coherent philosophy, because he'd be reluctant to say that about himself. I feel like there's more substance there. I feel like he's more grounded that way, philosophically and in terms of how he looks at people, looks at society, and so on. Here, frankly, I find it's perhaps more arbitrary, certainly crueler, and goodness knows Lynch can be extreme and cruel at times. But here, I think, again, with this filmmaker, I think he's cruel for the sake of being cruel. I think with other filmmakers like Lynch, there's a reason, there's a rationale, there's something there that keeps it tethered, if you will. What do you think of that? It's sort of a kind of awkward jousting point, because it's kind of hard to pin it down exactly, but what do you think of that?
I think it's adjacent to David Lynch, so maybe it was just a way of getting those fans to take a look at him. Like, oh, I like David Lynch, so I'm going to like this guy.
I don't know if I would connect the dots quite that directly, but I think at least indirectly there's something of that sort, because you want to establish your own presence, but it oftentimes seems like it's a sort of borrowed iconography that I don't, and because oftentimes it just seems totally meaningless to me. It's like, well, let's do this, let's do that. And with Lynch, I always feel like there's something underlying or underpinning. Well, I think a film like Blue Velvet, where as strange as and extreme as it gets, it's grounded in middle class, small town America. You can see how things are, what's down in the lawn, is there a body part down in the lawn? But as far out as it goes, you can still somehow keep it tethered to something resembling everyday reality. And that's what makes it so effective, right? I could be living in this town. This could happen to me or something. But whereas in this film, things are so extreme, it's just at some fable level, right? It's just some storybook level.
Yeah, if this is your town, you need to move out of town fast. So the last thing I wanted to ask you about, Mike, is the use of color. And I want to mention that that purple Dodge Challenger is Emma Stone's husband's car. But there's just some very unusual use of color in this. And I just wondered if you liked it, noticed it, thought it helped anything.
Well, you know what? This is congruent with what we've been saying, because of course I noticed it. It's there to be noticed. And sometimes, again, this director is visually clever. If you had still photos or watched just a scene or two, it's really striking. But why? It's almost like with color choices. Why this color and not that color? That's again a case where I think he's doing it just for effect. Now, let's say like when Almodóvar uses a bright red. There are emotional associations, whether it's with blood or romance or both. There are reasons for it. So it's not just visually striking, it's also thematically resonant. Here, to me, again, to use the word arbitrary, it seems like it's just saying, well, let's make it purple or let's do this or that. I don't see the underlying rationale for it.
Except, I guess, just to be interesting. But
Well, to get
that's
us talking about it,
to get us
right? I mean,
talking about,
that's
well, you know
what.
what? I will say I do think that people are going to be talking about this film for
It's
whatever
better
that's
to
worth.
talk about it than to watch it. So.
I think we're in agreement on that. All right, so that does bring us to the end of this episode, but don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.